This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Career of Evil. Written by Robert Galbraith. Read by Robert Glenister. To Sean and Matthew Harris. Do whatever you want with this dedication, but don't use it on your eyebrows. I choose to steal what you choose to show, and you know I will not apologize. You're mine for the taking. I'm making a career of evil. Blue Oyster Cult, Career of Evil. Lyrics by Patti Smith. Chapter 1. 2011. This ain't the summer of love. He had not managed to scrub off all her blood. A dark line like a parenthesis lay under the middle fingernail of his left hand. He set to digging it out, although he quite liked seeing it there. A memento of the previous day's pleasures. After a minute's fruitless scraping, he put the bloody nail in his mouth and sucked. The ferrous tang recalled the smell of the torrent that had splashed wildly onto the tiled floor, spattering the walls, drenching his jeans, and turning the peach-coloured bath towels, fluffy, dry, and neatly folded, into blood-soaked rags. Colours seemed brighter this morning. The world a lovelier place. He felt serene and uplifted, as though he had absorbed her, as though her life had been transfused into him. They belonged to you once you had killed them. It was a possession way beyond sex. Even to know how they looked at the moment of death was an intimacy way past anything two living bodies could experience. With a thrill of excitement, he reflected that nobody knew what he had done, nor what he was planning to do next. He sucked his middle finger, happy and at peace, leaning up against the warm wall in the weak April sunshine, his eyes on the house opposite. It was not a smart house. Ordinary. A nicer place to live, admittedly, than the tiny flat where yesterday's blood-stiffened clothing lay in black bin bags, awaiting incineration, and where his knives lay gleaming, washed clean with bleach, rammed up behind the U-bend under the kitchen sink. This house had a small front garden, black railings, and a lawn in need of mowing. Two white front doors had been crammed together side by side, showing that the three-story building had been converted into upper and lower flats. A girl called Robin Ellicott lived on the ground floor. Though he had made it his business to find out her real name, inside his own head, he called her the secretary. He had just seen her pass in front of the bow window, easily recognizable because of her bright hair. Watching the secretary was an extra, a pleasurable add-on. He had a few hours to spare, so he had decided to come and look at her. Today was a day of rest. Between the glories of yesterday and tomorrow. Between the satisfaction of what had been done and the excitement of what would happen next. The right-hand door opened unexpectedly, and the secretary came out, accompanied by a man. Still leaning into the warm wall, he stared along the street with his profile turned towards them, so that he might appear to be waiting for a friend. Neither of them paid him any attention. They walked off up the street side by side. After he had given them a minute's head start, he decided to follow. She was wearing jeans, a light jacket, and flat-heeled boots. Her long wavy hair was slightly ginger now that he saw her in the sunshine. He thought he detected a slight reserve between the couple, who weren't talking to each other. He was good at reading people. He had read and charmed the girl who had died yesterday, among the blood-soaked peach towels. Down the long residential street he tracked them, his hands in his pockets, ambling along as though heading for the shops, his sunglasses unremarkable on this brilliant morning. Trees waved gently in the slight spring breeze. At the end of the street, the pair ahead turned left into a wide, busy thoroughfare lined with offices. Sheet glass windows blazed high above him in the sunlight as they passed the Ealing Council building. Now the secretary's flatmate, or boyfriend, or whatever he was, clean-cut and square-jawed in profile, was talking to her. She returned a short answer and did not smile. Women were so petty, mean, dirty, and small. Sulky bitches, the lot of them, expecting men to keep them happy. Only when they lay dead and empty in front of you did they become purified, mysterious, and even wonderful. They were entirely yours then, unable to argue or struggle or leave, yours to do with whatever you liked. The other one's corpse had been heavy and floppy yesterday, after he had drained it of blood. His life-sized plaything. His toy. Through the bustling Arcadia shopping centre, he followed the secretary and her boyfriend, gliding behind them like a ghost or a god. Could the Saturday shoppers even see him? Or was he somehow transformed, doubly alive, gifted with invisibility? They had arrived at a bus stop. He hovered nearby, pretending to look through the door of a curry house, at fruit piled high in front of a grocer's, at cardboard masks of Prince William and Kate Middleton hanging in a newsagent's window, watching their reflections in the glass. They were going to get on the number 83. He did not have a lot of money in his pockets, but he was so enjoying watching her that he did not want it to end yet. As he climbed aboard behind them, he heard the man mention Wembley Central. He bought a ticket and followed them upstairs. The couple found seats together right at the front of the bus. He took a place nearby, next to a grumpy woman whom he forced to move her bags of shopping. Their voices carried sometimes over the hum of the other passengers. When not talking, the secretary looked out of the window, unsmiling. She did not want to go wherever they were going, he was sure of it. When she pushed a strand of hair out of her eyes, he noticed that she was wearing an engagement ring. So she was going to be getting married. Or so she thought. He hid his faint smile in the upturned collar of his jacket. The warm midday sun was pouring through the dirt-stippled bus windows. A group of men got on and filled the surrounding seats. A couple of them were wearing red and black rugby shirts. He felt suddenly as though the day's radiance had dimmed. Those shirts with the crescent moon and star had associations he did not like. They reminded him of a time when he had not felt like a god. He did not want his happy days spotted and stained by old memories, bad memories, but his elation was suddenly draining away. Angry now, a teenage boy in the group caught his eye, but looked hurriedly away, alarmed. He got up and headed back to the stairs. A father and his small son were holding tight to the pole beside the bus doors, an explosion of anger in the pit of his stomach. He should have had a son. Or rather, he should still have had a son. He pictured the boy standing beside him, looking up at him, hero-worshipping him. But his son was long gone, which was entirely due to a man called Cormoran Strike. He was going to have revenge on Cormoran Strike. He was going to wreak havoc upon him. When he reached the pavement, he looked up at the bus's front windows and caught one last glimpse of the secretary's golden head. He would be seeing her again in less than 24 hours. That reflection helped calm the sudden rage caused by the sight of those Saracen shirts. The bus rumbled off, and he strode away in the opposite direction, soothing himself as he walked. He had a wonderful plan. Nobody knew, nobody suspected. And he had something very special waiting for him in the fridge at home. Chapter 2. A rock through a window never comes with a kiss. Blue Oyster Cult, madness to the method. Robin Ellicott was 26 years old and had been engaged for over a year. Her wedding ought to have taken place 3 months previously, but the unexpected death of her future mother-in-law had led to the ceremony's postponement. Much had happened during the 3 months since the wedding should have happened. Would she and Matthew have been getting on better if vows had been exchanged, she wondered? Would they be arguing less if a golden band was sitting beneath the sapphire engagement ring that had become a little loose on her finger? Fighting her way through the rubble on Tottenham Court Road on Monday morning, Robin mentally relived the argument of the previous day. The seeds had been sown before they had even left the house for the rugby. Every time they met up with Sarah Shadlock and her boyfriend Tom, Robin and Matthew seemed to row, something that Robin had pointed out as the argument, which had been brewing since the match, dragged on into the small hours of the morning. Sarah was shit-stirring, for God's sake. Can't you see it? She was the one asking all about him, going on and on. I didn't start it. The everlasting roadworks around Tottenham Court Road Station had obstructed Robin's walk to work ever since she had started at the private detective agency in Denmark Street. Her mood was not improved by tripping on a large chunk of rubble. She staggered a few steps before recovering her balance. A barrage of wolf whistles and lewd remarks issued from a deep chasm in the road full of men in hard hats and fluorescent jackets. Shaking long strawberry blonde hair out of her eyes, red in the face, she ignored them, her thoughts returning irresistibly to Sarah Shadlock and her sly, persistent questions about Robin's boss. "He is strangely attractive, isn't he? Bit beaten up looking, but I've never minded that. Is he sexy in the flesh? He's a big guy, isn't he?" Robin had seen Matthew's jaw tightening as she tried to return cool, indifferent answers. "Is it just the two of you in the office? Is it really? Nobody else at all?" Bitch, thought Robin, whose habitual good nature had never stretched to Sarah Shadlock. She knew exactly what she was doing. "Is it true he was decorated in Afghanistan? Is it? Wow! So we're talking a war hero, too." Robin had tried her hardest to shut down Sarah's one-woman chorus of appreciation for Cormoran Strike, but to no avail. A coolness had crept into Matthew's manner towards his fiancée by the end of the match. His displeasure had not prevented him bantering and laughing with Sarah on the journey back from Vicarage Road, though, and Tom, whom Robin found boring and obtuse, had chortled away, oblivious to any undercurrents. Jostled by passers-by, also navigating the open trenches in the road, Robin finally reached the opposite pavement, passing beneath the shadow of the concrete grid-like monolith that was Centre Point, and becoming angry all over again as she remembered what Matthew had told her at midnight, when the argument had burst back into flame. "You can't stop bloody talking about him, can you? I heard you to Sarah. I did not start talking about him again. It was her. You weren't listening." But Matthew had imitated her, using the generic voice that stood for all women, high-pitched and imbecilic. "Oh, his hair's so lovely." "For God's sake, you're completely bloody paranoid," Robin had shouted. "Sarah was banging on about Jacques Berger's bloody hair, not Cormoran's, and all I said..."
"Not Cormoran's,"
he had repeated in that moronic squeal. As Robin rounded the corner into Denmark Street, she felt as furious as she had 8 hours ago, when she had stormed out of the bedroom to sleep on the sofa. Sarah Shadlock. Bloody Sarah Shadlock. Who had been at university with Matthew and had tried as hard as she could to win him away from Robin, the girl left behind in Yorkshire. If Robin could have been sure she would never see Sarah again, she would have rejoiced. But Sarah would be at their wedding in July. Sarah would doubtless continue to plague their married life, and perhaps one day she would try to worm her way into Robin's office to meet Strike, if her interest was genuine and not merely a means of sowing discord between Robin and Matthew. "I will never introduce her to Cormoran," thought Robin savagely, as she approached the courier standing outside the door to the office. He had a clipboard in one gloved hand and a long rectangular package in the other. "Is that for Ellicott?" Robin asked, as she came within speaking distance. She was expecting an order of ivory cardboard-covered disposable cameras, which were to be favours at the wedding reception. Her working hours had become so irregular of late that she found it easier to send online orders to the office rather than the flat. The courier nodded and held out the clipboard without taking off his motorcycle helmet. Robin signed and took the long package, which was much heavier than she had expected. It felt as though some single large object slid inside it as she put it under her arm. "Thank you," she said. But the courier had already turned away and swung a leg over his motorbike. She heard him ride away as she let herself inside the building. Up the echoing metal staircase that wound around the broken birdcage lift she walked, her heels clanging on the metal. The glass door flashed as she unlocked and opened it, and the engraved legend, C.B. Strike, Private Investigator, stood out darkly. She had arrived deliberately early. They were currently inundated with cases, and she wanted to catch up with some paperwork before resuming her daily surveillance of a young Russian lap dancer. From the sound of heavy footfalls overhead, she deduced that Strike was still upstairs in his flat. Robin laid her oblong package on the desk, took off her coat and hung it, with her bag, on a peg behind the door, turned on the light, filled and switched on the kettle, then reached for the sharp letter opener on her desk. Remembering Matthew's flat refusal to believe that it had been flanker Jacques Berger's curly mane she had been admiring, rather than Strike's short and frankly pube-like hair, she made an angry stab to the end of the package, slit it open, and pulled the box apart. A woman's severed leg had been crammed sideways in the box. The toes of the foot bent back to fit. Chapter 3. Half a Hero in a Hard-Hearted Game. Blue Oyster Cult, The Marshall Plan. Robin's scream reverberated off the windows. She backed away from the desk, staring at the obscene object lying there. The leg was smooth, slender and pale, and she had grazed it with her finger as she pulled its packaging open, felt the cold, rubbery texture of the skin. She had just managed to quell her scream by clamping her hands over her mouth when the glass door burst open beside her. 6'3" and scowling, Strike's shirt hung open, revealing a monkeyish mass of dark chest hair.
"What the—"
He followed her stricken gaze and saw the leg. She felt his hand close roughly over her upper arm, and he steered her out onto the landing.
"How did it arrive?"
"Courier," she said, allowing him to walk her up the stairs. "On a motorbike."
"Wait here. I'll call the police."
When he had closed the door of his flat behind her, she stood quite still, heart juddering, listening to his footsteps returning downstairs. Acid rose in her throat. A leg. She had just been given a leg. She had just carried a leg calmly upstairs, a woman's leg in a box. Whose leg was it? Where was the rest of her? She crossed to the nearest chair, a cheap affair of padded plastic and metal legs, and sat down, her fingers still pressed against her numb lips. The package, she remembered, had been addressed to her by name. Strike, meanwhile, was at the office window that looked down into the road, scanning Denmark Street for any sign of the courier, his mobile pressed to his ear. By the time he returned to the outer office to scrutinize the open package on the desk, he had made contact with the police.
"A leg?"
repeated Detective Inspector Eric Wardle on the end of the line.
"A fucking leg?"
"And it's not even my size," said Strike.
A joke he would not have made had Robin been present. His trouser leg was hitched up to reveal the metal rod that served as his right ankle. He had been in the process of dressing when he had heard Robin scream. Even as he said it, he realized that this was a right leg, like his own lost limb, and that it had been cut below the knee, which was exactly where he had been amputated. His mobile still clamped to his ear, Strike peered more closely at the limb. his nostrils filling with an unpleasant smell, like recently defrosted chicken. Caucasian skin. Smooth, pale and unblemished, but for an old greenish bruise on the calf, imperfectly shaven. The stubbly hairs were fair, and the unpainted toenails a little grubby. The severed tibia shone icy white against the surrounding flesh. A clean cut. Strike thought it likely to have been made by an axe or a cleaver.
A woman's, did you say?
Looks like...
Strike had noticed something else. There was scarring on the calf where the leg had been severed. Old scarring, unrelated to the wound that had taken it from the body. How many times during his Cornish childhood had he been caught unawares as he stood with his back to the treacherous sea? Those who did not know the ocean well forgot its solidity, its brutality. When it slammed into them with the force of cold metal, they were appalled. Strike had faced, worked with, and managed fear all his professional life. But the sight of that old scarring rendered him temporarily winded by a terror all the worse for its unexpectedness.
"Are you still there?" said Wardle, on the end of the line.
Strike's twice-broken nose was within an inch of the place where the woman's leg had been cut off. He was remembering the scarred leg of a child he had never forgotten. How long was it since he had seen her? How old would she be now?
"You called me first," Wardle prompted.
"Yeah," said Strike, forcing himself to concentrate.
"I'd rather you did it than anyone else, but if you can't..."
"I'm on my way," said Wardle. "Won't be long. Sit tight."
Strike turned off his phone and set it down, still staring at the leg. Now he saw that there was a note lying underneath it, a typed note. Trained by the British Army in investigative procedure, Strike resisted the powerful temptation to tug it out and read it. He must not taint forensic evidence. Instead, he crouched down unsteadily so that he could read the address hanging upside down on the open lid. The box had been addressed to Robin, which he did not like at all. Her name was correctly spelled, typed on a white sticker that bore the address of their office. This sticker overlay another. Squinting, determined not to reposition the box, even to read the address more clearly, he saw that the sender had first addressed the box to Cameron Strike, then overlain it with the second sticker reading Robin Ellicott. Why had they changed their mind?
"Fuck," said Strike quietly.
He stood up with some difficulty, took Robin's handbag from the peg behind the door, locked the glass door and headed upstairs.
"Police are on their way," he told her, as he set her bag down in front of her. "Want a cup of tea?"
She nodded.
"Want brandy in it?"
"You haven't got any brandy," she said. Her voice was slightly croaky.
"Have you been looking?"
"Of course not," she said.
And he smiled at how indignant she sounded, at the suggestion she might have been through his cupboards.
You're not the sort of person who'd have medicinal brandy."
"Want a beer?"
She shook her head, unable to smile. Once the tea had been made, Strike sat down opposite her with his own mug. He looked exactly what he was, a large ex-boxer who smoked too much and ate too much fast food. He had heavy eyebrows, a flattened and asymmetrical nose, and, when not smiling, a permanent expression of sullen crossness. His dense, dark, curly hair, still damp from the shower, reminded her of Jacques Burger and Sarah Shadlock. The row seemed a lifetime ago. She had only briefly thought of Matthew since coming upstairs. She dreaded telling him what had happened. He would be angry. He did not like her working for Strike.
"Have you looked at it?" she muttered, after picking up and setting down the boiling tea without drinking it.
"Yeah," said Strike.
She did not know what else to ask. It was a severed leg. The situation was so horrible, so grotesque, that every question that occurred to her sounded ridiculous, crass. Do you recognize it? Why do you think they sent it? And, most pressing of all, why to me?
The police will want to hear about the courier, he said.
I know, said Robin. I've been trying to remember everything about him. The downstairs door buzzer sounded.
That'll be Wardle.
Wardle? She repeated, startled.
He's the friendliest copper we know, Strike reminded her. Stay put. I'll bring him to you here.
Strike had managed to make himself unpopular among the Metropolitan Police over the previous year, which was not entirely his fault. The fulsome press coverage of his two most notable detective triumphs had understandably galled those officers whose efforts he had trumped. However, Wardle, who had helped him out on the first of those cases, had shared in some of the subsequent glory, and relations between them remained reasonably amicable. Robin had only ever seen Wardle in the newspaper reports of the case. Their paths had not crossed in court. He turned out to be a handsome man with a thick head of chestnut hair and chocolate brown eyes, who was wearing a leather jacket and jeans. Strike did not know whether he was more amused or irritated by the reflexive look Wardle gave Robin on entering the room. A swift zigzag sweep of her hair, her figure and her left hand, where his eyes lingered for a second on the sapphire and diamond engagement ring. Eric Wardle, he said in a low voice, with what Strike felt was an unnecessarily charming smile. And this is Detective Sergeant Equenzi. A thin, black female officer, whose hair was smoothed back in a bun, had arrived with him. She gave Robin a brief smile, and Robin found herself taking disproportionate comfort from the presence of another woman. Detective Sergeant Equenzi then let her eyes stray around Strike's glorified bedsit. "Where's this package?" she asked.
"Downstairs," said Strike, drawing the keys to the office out of his pocket. "I'll show you. Wife okay, Wardle?" he added, as he prepared to leave the room with Detective Sergeant Equenzi. "What do you care?" retorted the officer. But to Robin's relief, he dropped what she thought of as his counselor's manner as he took the seat opposite her at the table and flipped open his notebook.
"He was standing outside the door when I came up the street," Robin explained, when Wardle asked how the leg had arrived. "I thought he was a courier. He was dressed in black leather, all black except for blue stripes on the shoulders of his jacket. His helmet was plain black and the visor was down and mirrored. He must have been at least 6 feet tall, 4 or 5 inches taller than me, even allowing for the helmet."
"Build?" asked Wardle, who was scribbling in his notebook.
"Pretty big, I'd say, but he was probably padded out a bit by the jacket."
Robin's eyes wandered inadvertently to Strike as he re-entered the room. "I mean, not
a fat bastard like the boss,"
Strike, who had overheard, suggested, and Wardle, never slow to make or enjoy a dig at Strike, laughed under his breath.
"And he wore gloves," said Robin, who had not smiled. "Black leather motorcycle gloves."
"Of course he'd wear gloves," said Wardle, adding a note.
"I don't suppose you noticed anything about the motorbike?"
"It was a Honda, red and black," said Robin. "I noticed the logo, that wing symbol. I'd say 750cc. It was big."
Wardle looked both startled and impressed.
"Robin's a petrolhead," said Strike. "Drives like Fernando Alonso."
Robin wished that Strike would stop being cheery and flippant. A woman's leg lay downstairs. Where was the rest of her? She must not cry. She wished she had had more sleep. That damn sofa. She had spent too many nights on the thing lately.
"And he made you sign for it?" asked Wardle.
"I wouldn't say made me," said Robin. "He held out a clipboard and I did it automatically." What was on the clipboard? It looked like an invoice or... She closed her eyes in the effort to remember. Now she came to think of it, the form had looked amateurish, as though it had been put together on someone's laptop, and she said as much. "Were you expecting a package?" Wardle asked. Robin explained about the disposable wedding cameras. "What did he do once you'd taken it?" "Got back on the bike and left. He drove off into Charing Cross Road." There was a knock on the door of the flat, and Detective Sergeant De Quenzi reappeared holding the note that Strike had noticed lying beneath the leg, which was now enclosed in an evidence bag. "Forensics are here," she told Wardle. "This note was in the package. It would be good to know whether it means anything to Miss Ellicott." Wardle took the polythene-covered note and scanned it, frowning.
"It's gibberish," he said, then read aloud. "A harvest of limbs, of arms, and of legs, of necks that turn like swans," interrupted Strike, who was leaning against the cooker and too far away to read the note, "as if inclined to gasp or pray."
The other three stared at him.
"They're lyrics," said Strike.
Robin did not like the expression on his face. She could tell that the words meant something to him, something bad. With what looked like an effort, he elucidated.
"From the last verse of Mistress of the Salmon Salt by Blue Oyster Cult."
Detective Sergeant De Quenzi raised finely penciled eyebrows.
"Who?" "Big 70s rock band."
"You know their stuff well, I take it?" asked Wardle.
"I know that song," said Strike.
"Do you think you know who sent this?"
Strike hesitated. As the other three watched him, a confused series of images and memories passed rapidly through the detective's mind. A low voice said, "She wanted to die. She was the quicklime girl." The thin leg of a 12-year-old girl, scarred with silvery criss-crossing lines. A pair of small dark eyes like a ferret's, narrowed in loathing. The tattoo of a yellow rose. And then, lagging behind the other memories, puffing into view, although it might have been another man's first thought, he remembered a charge sheet that made mention of a penis cut from a corpse and mailed to a police informer.
"Do you know who sent it?" repeated Wardle. "Maybe," said Strike.
He glanced at Robin and Detective Sergeant De Quenzi.
"I'd rather talk about it alone. Have you got everything you want from Robin?"
"We'll need your name and address and so on," said Wardle. "Vanessa, can you take those?"
Detective Sergeant De Quenzi moved forwards with her notebook. The two men's clanging footsteps faded from earshot. In spite of the fact that she had no desire to see the severed leg again, Robin felt aggrieved at being left behind. It had been her name on the box. The grisly package was still lying on the desk downstairs. Two more of Wardle's colleagues had been admitted by Detective Sergeant De Quenzi. One was taking photographs, the other talking on his mobile, when their senior officer and the private detective walked past. Both looked curiously at Strike, who had achieved a measure of fame during the period in which he had managed to alienate many of Wardle's colleagues. Strike closed the door of his inner office, and he and Wardle took the seats facing each other across Strike's desk. Wardle turned to a fresh page of his notebook.
"All right. Who do you know likes chopping up corpses and sending them through the post?"
"Terence Malley," said Strike, after a momentary hesitation, "for a start."
Wardle did not write anything, but stared at him over the top of his pen.
"Terence Digger Malley?"
Strike nodded.
"Haringey Crime Syndicate."
"How many Terence Digger Malleys do you know?" asked Strike impatiently. "And how many have got a habit of sending people body parts?"
How the hell did you get mixed up with Digger?
Joint ops with Voice Squad 2008, drug ring.
The bust he went down for?
Exactly.
Holy shit, said Wardle.
Well, that's bloody it, isn't it? The guy's an effing lunatic. He's just out, and he's got easy access to half of London's prostitutes. We'd better start dragging a Thames for the rest of her.
Yeah, but I gave evidence anonymously. He shouldn't ever have known it was me.
They've got ways and means, said Wardle. Haringey Crime Syndicate, they're like the fucking mafia. Did you hear how he sent Hatford Alley's dick to Ian Bevin?
Yeah, I heard, said Strike.
So what's the story with the song? The harvest of whatever the fuck it was.
Well, that's what I'm worried about, said Strike slowly. It seems pretty subtle for the likes of Digger. Which makes me think it might be one of the other three.
Chapter 4 Four winds at the Four Winds Bar, two doors locked and windows barred. One door left to take you in, the other one just mirrors it. Blue Oyster Cult, Astronomy. You know four men who'd send you a severed leg. Four. Strike could see Robin's appalled expression reflected in the round mirror standing beside the sink where he was shaving. The police had taken away the leg at last. Strike had declared work suspended for the day, and Robin remained at the little formica table in his kitchen-come-sitting room, cradling a second mug of tea.
"To tell you the truth," he said, strafing stubble from his chin, "I think it's only three. Think I might have made a mistake telling Wardle about Mally."
"Why?" Strike told Robin the story of his brief contact with the career criminal who owed his last prison stretch in part to Strike's evidence.
"So now Wardle's convinced the Haringey Crime Syndicate found out who I was. But I left for Iraq shortly after testifying, and I've never yet known an SIB officer's cover blown because he gave evidence in court. Plus, the song lyrics don't smell like Digger. He's not one for fancy touches."
"But he's cut bits off people he's killed before?" Robin asked.
"Once that I know of. But don't forget, whoever did this hasn't necessarily killed anyone," temporized Strike. "The leg could have come off an existing corpse, could be hospital waste. Wardle's going to check all that out. We won't know much until forensics have had a look."
The ghastly possibility that the leg had been taken from a still-living person, he chose not to mention. In the ensuing pause, Strike rinsed his razor under the kitchen tap, and Robin stared out of the window, lost in thought. "Well, you had to tell Wardle about Mally," said Robin, turning back to Strike, who met her gaze in his shaving mirror. "I mean, if he's already sent someone a... What exactly did he send?" she asked, a little nervously.
"A penis," said Strike.
He washed his face clean and dried it on a towel before continuing.
"Yeah, maybe you're right. More I think about it, though, the surer I am it's not him. Back in a minute, I want to change this shirt. I ripped two buttons off it when you screamed."
"Sorry," said Robin vaguely, as Strike disappeared into the bedroom. Sipping her tea, she took a look around the room in which she was sitting. She had never been inside Strike's attic flat before. The most she had done previously was knock on the door to deliver messages or, in some of their busiest and most sleep-deprived stretches, to wake him up. The kitchen-come-sitting room was cramped, but clean and orderly. There were virtually no signs of personality. Mismatched mugs, a cheap tea towel folded beside the gas ring, no photographs and nothing decorative, save for a child's drawing of a soldier which had been tacked up on one of the wall units.
"Who drew that?" she asked,
when Strike reappeared in a clean shirt.
"My nephew, Jack. He likes me for some reason."
"Don't fish."
"I'm not fishing. I never know what to say to kids."
"So you think you've met three men who would have...
Robin began again. I want a drink, said Strike. Let's go to the Tottenham.
There was no possibility of talking on the way, not with the racket of pneumatic drills still issuing from the trenches in the road. But the fluorescent-jacketed workman neither wolf-whistled nor cat-called with Strike walking at Robin's side. At last, they reached Strike's favourite local pub, with its ornate gilded mirrors, its panels of dark wood, its shining brass pumps, the coloured glass cupola, and the paintings of gambling beauties by Felix de Jong. Strike ordered a pint of Doombar. Robin, who could not face alcohol, asked for a coffee. So, said Robin, once the detective had returned to the high table beneath the cupola. Who are the three men?
I could be barking up a forest of wrong trees, don't forget, said Strike, sipping his pint.
All right, said Robin. Who are they?
Twisted individuals who've all got good reason to hate my guts.
Inside Strike's head, a frightened, skinny 12-year-old girl with scarring around her leg surveyed him through the lopsided glasses. Had it been her right leg? He couldn't remember.
Jesus, don't let it be her.
Who? Robin said again, losing patience.
There are two army guys, said Strike, rubbing his stubbly chin. They're both crazy enough and violent enough to...
A gigantic, involuntary yawn interrupted him. Robin waited for cogent speech to resume, wondering whether he had been out with his new girlfriend the previous evening. Ellen was an ex-professional violinist, now a presenter on Radio 3, a stunning Nordic-looking blonde who reminded Robin of a more beautiful Sarah Shadlock. She supposed that this was one reason why she had taken an almost immediate dislike to Ellen. The other was that she had, in Robin's hearing, referred to her as Strike's secretary.
Sorry, Strike said. I was up late writing up notes for the Khan job. Knackered.
He checked his watch.
Shall we go downstairs and eat? I'm starving.
In a minute. It's not even 12. I want to know about these men. Strike sighed.
All right, he said, dropping his voice as a man passed their table on the way to the bathroom. Donald Lang. King's Own Royal Borderers.
He remembered again eyes like a ferret's, concentrated hatred, the rose tattoo.
I got him life.
But then?
Out in 10, said Strike. He's been on the loose since 2007. Lang wasn't your run-of-the-mill nutter. He was an animal. A clever, devious animal. A sociopath, the real deal, if you ask me. I got him life for something I shouldn't have been investigating. He was about to get off on the original charge. Lang's got bloody good reason to hate my guts.
But he did not say what Lang had done or why he, Strike, had been investigating it. Sometimes, and frequently when talking about his career in the Special Investigation Branch, Robin could tell by Strike's tone when he had come to the point beyond which he did not wish to speak. She had never yet pushed him past it. Reluctantly, she abandoned the subject of Donald Lang. Who was the other army guy?
Noel Brockbank, Desert Rat.
Desert what?
7th Armoured Brigade.
Strike was becoming steadily more taciturn, his expression brooding. Robin wondered whether this was because he was hungry. He was a man who needed regular sustenance to maintain an equable mood, or for some darker reason. "Shall we eat, then?" Robin asked.
"Yeah," said Strike, draining his pint and getting to his feet.
The cosy basement restaurant comprised a red-carpeted room with a second bar, wooden tables, and walls covered in framed prints. They were the first to sit down and order. You were saying about Noel Brockbank, Robin prompted Strike when he had chosen fish and chips and she had asked for a salad.
Yeah, he's another one with good reason to hold a grudge, said Strike shortly.
He had not wanted to talk about Donald Lang, and he was showing even more reluctance to discuss Brockbank. After a long pause, in which Strike glared over Robin's shoulder at nothing, he said,
Brockbank's not right in the head, or so he claimed.
Did you put him in prison?
No, said Strike.
His expression had become forbidding. Robin waited, but she could tell nothing more was coming on Brockbank, so she asked, And the other one? This time, Strike did not answer at all. She thought he had not heard her.
Who's I don't want to talk about it? Grunted Strike.
He glowered into his fresh pint, but Robin refused to be intimidated.
Whoever sent that leg, she said, sent it to me.
All right, said Strike grudgingly, after a brief hesitation. His name's Jeff Whittaker.
Robin felt a thrill of shock. She did not need to ask how Strike knew Jeff Whittaker. She already knew, although they had never discussed him. Cormoran Strike's early life was extensively documented on the internet, and it had been endlessly rehashed by the press coverage of his detective triumphs. He was the illegitimate and unplanned offspring of a rock star and a woman always described as a super groupie, a woman who had died of an overdose when Strike was 20. Jeff Whittaker had been her much younger second husband, who had been accused and acquitted of her murder. They sat in silence until their food arrived.
Why are you only having a salad? Aren't you hungry? Asked Strike, clearing his plate of chips.
As Robin had suspected, his mood had improved with the ingestion of carbohydrates. Wedding, said Robin shortly. Strike said nothing. Comments on her figure fell strictly outside the self-imposed boundaries he had established for their relationship, which he had determined from the outset must never become too intimate. Nevertheless, he thought she was becoming too thin. In his opinion, and even the thought fell outside those same boundaries, she looked better, curvier. "Aren't you even going to tell me?" Robin asked, after several more minutes' silence. What your connection with that song is. He chewed for a while, drank more beer, ordered another pint of Doombar, then said,
My mother had the title tattooed on her.
He did not fancy telling Robin exactly where the tattoo had been. He preferred not to think about that. However, he was mellowing with food and drink. Robin had never showed prurient interest in his past, and he supposed she was justified in a request for information today.
It was her favourite song. Blue Oyster Cult were her favourite band. Well, favourite is an understatement. Obsession, really.
Her favourite wasn't the Deadbeats? Asked Robin without thinking. Strike's father was the lead singer of the Deadbeats. They had never discussed him either.
No, said Strike, managing a half-smile. Old Johnny came a poor second with Leda. She wanted Eric Bloom, lead singer of Blue Oyster Cult, but she never got him. One of the very few who got away.
Robin was not sure what to say. She had wondered before what it felt like to have your mother's epic sexual history online for anybody to see. Strike's fresh pint arrived, and he took a swig before continuing.
I was nearly christened Eric Bloom, Strike, he said,
and Robin choked on her water. He laughed as she coughed into a napkin.
Let's face it, Cormoran's not much bloody better. Cormoran Blue.
Blue?
Blue Oyster Cult, aren't you listening?
God, said Robin, you keep that quiet.
Wouldn't you?
What does it mean, mistress of the salmon salt?
Search me. Their lyrics are insane, science fiction, crazy stuff.
A voice in his head. She wanted to die. She was the quicklime girl. He drank more beer. I don't think I've ever heard any Blue Oyster Cult, said Robin.
Yeah, you have, Strike contradicted her. Don't fear the Reaper.
Don't? What?
It was a monster hit for him. Don't fear the Reaper.
Oh, I see. For one startled moment, Robin had thought that he was giving her advice. They ate in silence for a while, until Robin, unable to keep the question down any longer, though hoping she did not sound scared, asked, Why do you think the leg was addressed to me? Strike had already had time to ponder this question.
I've been wondering that, he said. And I think we've got to consider it a tacit threat, so, until we've found out...
I'm not stopping work, said Robin fiercely. I'm not staying at home. That's what Matthew wants.
You've spoken to him, have you?
She had made the call while Strike was downstairs with Wardle. Yes. He's angry with me for signing for it.
I expect he's worried about you, said Strike, insincerely.
He had met Matthew on a handful of occasions and disliked him more each time. He's not worried, snapped Robin. He just thinks that this is it, that I'll have to leave now, that I'll be scared out. I won't. Matthew had been appalled at her news, but even so, she had heard a faint trace of satisfaction in his voice, felt his unexpressed conviction that now, at last, she must see what a ridiculous choice it had been to throw in her lot with a rackety private detective who could not afford to give her a decent salary. Strike had her working unsociable hours that meant she had to have packages sent to work instead of the flat. I didn't get sent a leg because Amazon couldn't deliver to the house, Robin had said hotly. And of course, on top of everything else, Strike was now mildly famous and a source of fascination to their friends. Matthew's work as an accountant did not carry quite the same cachet. His resentment and jealousy ran deep and increasingly burst their bounds. Strike was not fool enough to encourage Robin in any disloyalty to Matthew that she might regret when she was less shaken.
Addressing the leg to you instead of me was an afterthought, he said. They put my name on there first. I reckon they were either trying to worry me by showing they knew your name, or trying to frighten you off working for me.
Well, I'm not going to be frightened off, said Robin.
Robin, this is no time for heroics. Whoever he is, he's telling us he knows a lot about me, that he knows your name, and, as of this morning, exactly what you look like. He saw you up close. I don't like that.
You obviously don't think my counter-surveillance abilities are up to much.
Seeing as you're talking to the man who sent you on the best bloody course I could find, said Strike, and who read that fulsome letter of commendation you shoved under my nose,
then you don't think my self-defense is any good.
I've never seen any of it, and I've only got your word that you ever learned any.
Have you ever known me lie about what I can and can't do? Demanded Robin, affronted. And Strike was forced to acknowledge that he had not. Well then, I won't take stupid risks. You've trained me to notice anyone dodgy. Anyway, you can't afford to send me home. We're struggling to cover our cases as it is. Strike sighed and rubbed his face with two large, hairy-backed hands.
Nothing after dark, he said.
And you need to carry an alarm, a decent one. Fine, she said.
Anyway, you're doing Radford from next Monday, he said, taking comfort from the thought.
Radford was a wealthy entrepreneur who wanted to put an investigator, posing as a part-time worker, into his office to expose what he suspected were criminal dealings by a senior manager. Robin was the obvious choice because Strike had become more recognizable since their second high-profile murder case. As Strike drained his third pint, he wondered whether he might be able to convince Radford to increase Robin's hours. He would be glad to know she was safe in a palatial office block 9 to 5 every day until the maniac who had sent the leg was caught. Robin, meanwhile, was fighting waves of exhaustion and a vague nausea. A row, a broken night, the dreadful shock of the severed leg, and now she would have to head home and justify all over again her wish to continue doing a dangerous job for a bad salary. Matthew, who had once been one of her primary sources of comfort and support, had become merely another obstacle to be navigated. Unbidden, unwanted, the image of the cold, severed leg in its cardboard box came back to her. She wondered when she would stop thinking about it. The fingertips that had grazed it tingled unpleasantly. Unconsciously, she tightened her hand into a fist in her lap. Chapter 5. Hells Built on Regret. Blue Oyster Cult, The Revenge of Vera Gemini. Lyrics by Patti Smith. Much later, after he had seen Robin safely onto the tube, Strike returned to the office and sat alone in silence at her desk, lost in thought. He had seen plenty of dismembered corpses, seen them rotting in mass graves and lying freshly blown apart by roadsides, severed limbs, flesh pulped, bones crushed. Unnatural death was the business of the Special Investigation Branch, the plainclothes wing of the Royal Military Police, and his colleagues' reflexive reaction had often been humour. That was how you coped when you saw the dead torn and mutilated. Not for the SIB, the luxury of corpses washed and prettified in satin-lined boxes. Boxes. It had looked quite ordinary, the cardboard box in which the leg had come. No markings to indicate its origin, no trace of a previous addressee, nothing. The whole thing had been so organized, so careful, so neat. And this was what unnerved him, not the leg itself, nasty object though it was. What appalled him was the careful, meticulous, almost clinical modus operandi. Strike checked his watch. He was supposed to be going out with Ellen this evening. His girlfriend of 2 months was in the throes of a divorce that was proceeding with the chilly brinkmanship of a grandmaster chess tournament. Her estranged husband was very wealthy, something that Strike had not realized until the first night he had been permitted to come back to the marital home and found himself in a spacious, wood-floored apartment overlooking Regent's Park. The shared custody arrangements meant that she was only prepared to meet Strike on nights when her 5-year-old daughter was not at home. And when they went out, they chose the capital's quieter and more obscure restaurants, as Ellen did not wish her estranged husband to know that she was seeing anyone else. The situation suited Strike perfectly. It had been a perennial problem in his relationships that the normal nights for recreation were often nights that he had to be out tailing other people's unfaithful partners, and he had no particular desire to kindle a close relationship with Ellen's daughter. He had not lied to Robin. He did not know how to talk to children. He reached for his mobile. There were a few things he could do before he left for dinner. The first call went to voicemail. He left a message asking Graham Hardacre, his ex-colleague in the Special Investigation Branch, to call him. He was not sure where Hardacre was currently stationed. The last time they had spoken, he had been due a move from Germany. To Strike's disappointment, his second call, which was to an old friend whose life path had run more or less in the opposite direction to that of Hardacre, was not picked up either. Strike left a second, almost identical message and hung up. Pulling Robin's chair closer to the computer, he turned it on and stared at the homepage without seeing it. The image that was filling his mind, entirely against his will, was of his mother, naked. Who had known the tattoo was there? Her husband, obviously, and the many boyfriends who had woven in and out of her life, and anyone else who might have seen her undressed in the squats and the filthy communes in which they had intermittently lived. Then there was the possibility that had occurred to him in the Tottenham, but which he had not felt equal to sharing with Robin, that Leda had, at some point, been photographed in the nude. It would have been entirely in character. His fingers hovered over the keyboard. He got as far as Leda, strike, make, before deleting letter by letter with an angry jabbing forefinger. There were places no